Amen. Thank you to Derek and Jean for that team reading and relay. What a wonderful reading team. Thank you. And thank you to our music too. It's marvellous today. The Lord is here, I think, isn't he, in our worship. So thank you. I love this church. Can I just say one little thing before I start? When we went out to Nepal to visit Chitra, they asked us to take a book of photographs of the churches and of our family and everything. I thought, I haven't got a photograph of all the church people. So could we, before we grab our coffee, immediately after the service, would you mind if we just pop outside and just take a snap for publicity purposes and so on of all the church folk just outside the door here? That would be really kind. Thank you. Okay, well, we're in this little series on the prophet Elisha. And due to the wonders of the internet, if you want to, you can listen again to previous sermons on the Mark Tay Church website. And we've heard about the background of first Elijah and now his successor, Elisha. And we've seen how Elisha seems to do sometimes almost the same carbon copy miracles as Elijah did, to follow in the footsteps of his mentor. And this week, we're looking at the third era in Elisha's life. And it starts with a couple of little vignettes, little stories of Elisha neutralizing some poison in the prophet's supper, and then of him multiplying loaves of bread, a sort of precursor of Jesus' miracle. And in both cases, he sticks his neck out and he simply prophesies what will happen, what the Lord will do. And it seems as if God works the miracle exactly as Elisha says. Actually, I think it's more likely that God plans the miracle in advance and tells Elisha what to prophesy. But then, in the reading that Derek and Jean read to us, then follows one of the great stories of the Bible, I think, the story of Naaman. Page 373, if you're following it in a Bible. Those names with a double A, they're a bit tricky for us Brits, aren't they? Four common ones. Well, there are two with the sort of double A as a second syllable. The land of Canaan, C-A-N-A-A-N, Canaan, and the prophet Balaam, B-A-L-A-A-M, in Numbers 23. So those are one way it occurs. But the other way it occurs is the double A as the first syllable, the Canaanite god Baal. And what you're meant to do is just sort of slightly separate the two A's, Baal. And here, the story of Naaman. Again, slightly separating Naaman. But they're tricky words, aren't they? Doesn't matter, to be honest. If you just say it confidently, then people will assume that's the way it should be said. So there we go. Naaman, the commander of the army of the Arameans. Aram was a highland region to the north and east of Israel. Now, roughly the area that we call Syria, with the capital Damascus. And Naaman was clearly an excellent career soldier. He'd risen to the top of the army, and he was the commander of it all. But he suffered from leprosy. And that could have been any one of a variety of skin diseases. We don't know exactly what they meant by leprosy. But it did mean that people would have kept their distance from him. He wouldn't have been able to mingle in society. Actually, when Jane and I were in Nepal, we saw lepers. We met them. And what we call leprosy attacks nerves, and I think it probably did in Bible days as well, so that your fingers and your hands and your feet and legs become numb. You can't feel them at all. And what that means is that you tend to trip over things and cut yourself and injure yourself and get sores, because you don't turn over. You don't realize when something's rubbing or whatever, when your sandals are rubbing on your feet. So your hands and your feet get infected, and of course eventually that leads to having to be amputated, or you know, you lose the use of hands and feet. And we saw sufferers who, you know, had stumps, you know, at the ends of their their arms and so on. And so they were fitting in the hospitals, they were fitting artificial hands, very basic ones, you know, sort of plastic ones, but it would at least allow you to hold something or grip something. And then they were fitting tools that would go over sort of two fingers of the artificial hand. Amazing work in Green Pastures Hospital. But it brought home how disabling leprosy must have been. And Naaman heard from his wife's Jewish maid about the prophet in Samaria. And the first thing he does is draw on his connections, his power and influence. He sorts out a formal king-to-king entreaty to the king of neighbouring Israel. You can tell that he's well connected in his country. And he takes lots of valuable gifts and presents and so on. But the king of Israel is not one of the better kings. His name's Jehoram. He's the son of Ahab. And Ahab and Jezebel, Ahab was the king who troubled Elijah and persecuted him and gave him grief. Jehoram, just before the reading we had, makes a bit of an ass of himself in 2 Kings 3 with a sort of campaign against neighbouring countries. And when Jehoram hears of this request, he doesn't even think of Elisha at all. He just assumes that this is a hostile approach from the neighbouring country. But Elisha is at the peak of his powers, and he knows exactly what's going on and what's being said. He seems to know everything. In the following chapter after this, he sort of acts as a spiritual bugging device, and he tells the king of Israel by divine revelation exactly what the enemy king is planning. In the secrecy of his bedroom, Elisha says, he's thinking this, he's planning this, he's giving these orders. And here he knows what the king of Israel has said to Naaman. And he sends a message, tell the king of Israel to send him to me, and then he'll know that there is a prophet in Israel. And so the VIP Naaman arrives at Elisha's house and rings the doorbell or knocks on the door. By the way, if you come to the new rectory, don't bother ringing the doorbell. It doesn't work yet. The builders are working on that. Knock on the door instead. You'll do better. But Naaman comes to Elisha's house, and Elisha seems to sense that he needs taking down a peg or two. You know those stories in the Gospels where Jesus seems to know that some people need taking down a peg or two? The rich young ruler, Jesus knows what he needs. You need to sell all your goods and give to the poor and come follow me. Jesus doesn't say that to everybody, but he knows what each person needs, doesn't he? Or Simon the Pharisee, Jesus having a meal in his house, and you remember there was a woman of ill repute who came and wept over Jesus' feet and washed his feet with her tears and her hair and so on. Simon is sort of thinking, oh dear, if only he knew. Jesus knows what's in Simon's heart and says, she who has been forgiven much loves much. He who has been forgiven little loves little. Took him down a peg or two from his arrogance and pride. Or Zacchaeus, the little man who climbed the tree, gave away his ill-gotten gains, didn't he? Or the Pharisee and the tax collector praying side by side. It's one thing that Jesus absolutely loathed was pride and arrogance, and especially in religious people. And I think Elisha's on the same crusade here. Before he even claps eyes on Naaman at all, he knows what his problem is. It's not just his leprosy, it's also his pride inside. Set me thinking, why is pride such a hateful sin? Because we used to talk, didn't we, about having pride in your work, in a job well done, for example. We see nothing wrong, do we, in being proud of your family or your background or your country or whatever. I think the problem begins when you are proud of yourself. I was taught when I was young that both words, pride and sin, both words have I at the centre of the word. And that's the essence of sin. It's about me, me, me. Self-centeredness, self-absorption. Saint Augustine described sin as being incurvatus in se, being turned in on yourself, focused on yourself. Just think for a moment, Jesus, by contrast, Jesus has been described as the man for others. He lived out the self-giving nature of God, didn't he? Supremely, of course, when he gave his life for you and me on the cross. Many of the songs we've been singing talk about Jesus giving himself for us. So one of the first steps towards being a Christian is actually to renounce self-interest and to put God in the driving seat of your life. And Elisha knew that was what Naaman needed. That was, if you like, the first step for Naaman. And so Elisha sent a messenger out of the house to just go and tell Naaman to wash himself in the local river. Go on, go and wash it. Bit of a calculated insult, really. Imagine if a VIP came to your house and rang the doorbell. Would you send someone out and tell them to go and wash before you'll see them? You wouldn't do it, would you? It's a bit of a slap in the face, really. And Naaman predictably takes umbrage, stomps off in a huff. But notice Elisha's words in verse 10. Notice his exact words. Because Elisha's done as he usually does. He's prophesied boldly what will happen if Naaman acts. It's the first step, actually, in my 3 points from last week. Do you remember? Prophesy boldly, believe firmly, and act urgently. Elisha's told Naaman that if he does this, if he goes and washes in the Jordan, he will be cleansed of his disease. It's quite brave, isn't it, to stick your neck out like that? At New Wine last summer, they were teaching us to be brave. If the Lord nudges you, the worst that can happen is you look a bit silly, isn't it? But the best that can happen is the Lord acts, and you've been part of it. So Elisha here says, look, if you go and wash in the Jordan 7 times, you will be cleansed of this disease, this leprosy. And that's actually Naaman's whole purpose, isn't it, in travelling here. He's come a long way. He's gone to a lot of trouble. It's his deepest longing, but he can't hear it because of his pride. And verse 11, I think, is a wonderful sort of verbatim rant from Naaman about his fixed expectations of what he thought would happen. I wonder if we ever do that. Do we sometimes go to the doctor with our own ideas of what's going to be prescribed for us, what pills we need, or what treatment we should have? You know, people came to Jesus like that as well. And they were then offended when he took a different tack. Do you remember the paralytic that they let down through the roof? And Jesus said, your sins are forgiven. And they took offence. They said, surely, can't he see? The man's paralysed. You know, come on, Jesus, get with the programme. They took offence because the doctor prescribed something different to what they were expecting. You've come to the expert, so listen to his diagnosis. And that's true most of all, isn't it, when we come to God and bring a problem to God. We tend to think, oh, we know what God ought to do. No, listen to his answer. Don't get on your high horse when it's not what you expected or when something different happens. And Naaman's rant continues, comparing this muddy little river here with the great rivers of his capital city, Damascus. You can tell there's a bit of competition between the nations going on there. But surely, Naaman, in truth, if it cures you of your disease, then that's all you need, isn't it? Naaman wants a bit of pomp and ceremony and so on, and a magnificent, wide, clean, posh river too. One of the things we saw in Kathmandu was one of their holy rivers running through a Hindu temple site, and it was horrible. It stank, and it had rubbish in it, and it had diseased monkeys playing in it and so on, but for them it was the holy river. And who's to gainsay that? The holy rivers aren't always the pretty ones or the clean ones. And thankfully, Naaman's servants had more presence of mind than he did. They're watching what's going on. They're a little bit more detached from the action. And what's more, like the little Hebrew maid at the beginning of the story, they really care for their master. They want to see him healed. And they have the courage to speak up in front of him too. I think he must have been a good man to work for, mustn't he? That they had that bravery. They address him as my father. Doubtless a sign of respect, I think. And they point out that all he's been asked to do is a very, very simple thing. Just do it and be cleansed. And to his credit, he listens and he understands and he acts urgently. He goes and does it. I can remember when I was a teenager hearing a preacher telling this story, actually from a big old-fashioned wooden pulpit. And he sort of dramatized the grumpy general, grumbling as he put his head under, you know, oh, if I have to, one. I thought at least he'd come out of his house, two. Stand there before me, three. Call on the name of the Lord his God, four. Wave his hand over the spot, five. Cure me of his leprosy, how many is that? Six. Dirty little river, seven. Wow, look at my hands. He'd been cured of his disease. Better than L'Oreal or Laboratoires, anything. His flesh had become like that of a young boy, a young child. And of course, then it was time to eat humble pie, wasn't it? And he goes back to Elisha's house, and this time the prophet does come out. Naaman's clean. And Naaman admits he learned his lesson, that there's no God in all the world except Israel. And he offers a generous and valuable gift. But Elisha refuses and says no. Naaman offers it again. Elisha refuses again. God cannot be bought or paid for. And especially healings and blessings cannot be bought and paid for. There are, it has to be said, there are some American and Australian evangelists who give that impression that if you give a generous donation, then God's blessings will flow. Make a large donation and God will be with you. If you ever hear that, don't believe it. It's not true. God is not some sort of slot machine where you can put in money and get out blessing. It doesn't happen like that. In the New Testament, when a magician offered money, he was cursed by the Apostle Peter. He was in real trouble. By contrast, what we try to teach worshippers is to give a straight proportion of our income as an expression of our worship to God, regularly and systematically. Not just when we feel blessed, not just when we like the music or something like that. And also, actually, we pay clergy a stipend, in other words, a living allowance, not a salary related to performance or related to working hours or something like that, simply enough to live on. I think the lesson is that the rewards of faith are given by God. They're not given by mammon. The rewards of faith are given by God alone. And Naaman gets it, to his credit. He's one of those people who are spiritually aware and open. And he asks instead, can he take some earth from Israel, standing on which he can worship the God of Israel, even though he's in his capital, Damascus? But he asks forgiveness in advance that he'll continue to stand and bow with the king before the Aramean god Rimmon. And Elisha gives God's absolution for that. And then the final sting in the tale, in the story, is Gehazi's, the servant Gehazi's undoing. Chasing after Naaman with dollar signs in his eyes, telling fibs to get some profit for himself out of all of this. But as always, Elisha knows exactly what's going on. Was not my spirit with you when the man got down from his chariot to meet you? And Gehazi acquires not only Naaman's wealth, but also his leprosy. A fitting end to the story. What can we learn, just to come into land, as some preachers say? What can we learn from all this? Jesus clearly loved this story too. He quotes it in Luke 4:27. It's an example of God and his prophets blessing and receiving honor from foreigners, but being despised in their hometown. I think it's a story mainly about honoring God and worshiping God, and how sometimes our pride can get in the way of that. Perhaps we focus on the outward things, the style of music that we prefer, or the form of words that we like, or the type of people we want to associate with when we come to church, or even the flower arrangements or something. We focus on the externals, don't we? And we forget who it is that we've come to worship. Seek first his kingdom and his righteousness, and all these things will be yours as well, says Jesus. So I think the challenge is this, that when some aspect of Christian taste or style irritates you, and it will, take it as a challenge. Say to yourself now, okay, maybe I hate this music, or maybe I'm not keen on this building or whatever, but where can I find God in this? What is God saying to me? Even if my sense of taste is offended, how can God speak to me? Ask yourself those questions, because like Naaman, if you humble yourself, you will receive blessing from God. And may his name be praised. Amen.